When cybercriminals lock up a children's hospital, denying treatment to kids with cancer, you realize just how dark the world of ransomware has become. Healthcare isn't just another target, it is the lifeline of our society, and it is under siege. In this episode, we're going to look at the reality of this growing feeding frenzy of cyber attacks on healthcare, the rise of AI-driven threats, and what it truly takes to defend the systems and the people who keep us alive. It is a lesson on the human element of defense, the human firewall, and it can be applied to any industry. To help us gain perspective on the growing threats of cybercriminals and the many strategies available to organizations, I am joined by Dr. Adrian Mayers, Vice President and Chief Information Security Officer at Primera Blue Cross. Can I ask you just to tell us what Primera does? Where do you fit into the healthcare scenario for those who may not be familiar with your brand?
Primera Blue Cross operates in Washington and Alaska, and we are a plan and a payer. So what does that mean? That means that we are the bridge, if you will, to make sure that people have access to healthcare. So we work with providers, doctors, dentists, clinicians. We work with our members to make sure that we are kind of that middle ground. So they have health plans. So we provide those health plans. We give them and provide them access to doctors. They go, they submit a claim. We pay the claims. We pay the doctors. So truly the banking system, if you will, of U.S. healthcare. You'll hear me reference that again as we work through this, because I think it's an important point. But that's what Primera does primarily in Washington and Alaska.
We've now got a description of what Primera does. So we're looking at an industry that is on the front lines of people's lives and livelihood. But we're also seeing it being an enormous target for insider threats, external cybersecurity activities, of course, and things being driven and amplified by generative AI now, of course. So what are you seeing being out there on the front lines? What have you seen in terms of the changes, let's say, in the last year or two? Because we've had cybersecurity incidents in healthcare for many, many years. But what have you seen as an alarming or completely manageable change in healthcare threats that are AI generated?
I think there's a couple of things that are going on. I use this term pretty often when it comes to threat actor activity, specifically on healthcare. And this is coming from organized crime syndicates that are operating in cyber as well as nation state threat actors. And there's a little bit of a, what I like to call a feeding frenzy when it comes to ransomware and seeing from their perspective, healthcare, hospitals, what have you, as legitimate targets for ransomware and for other nefarious activity. When you think about it, completely deplorable. The fact that somebody would lock up a children's hospital with ransomware where kids can't get their cancer treatments is incredible to me. So when you talk about manageability, though, we have to manage. We have to manage through it. We have to figure out different ways and strategies to work with this, because this is a legitimate concern, issue, challenge that requires us to rethink and revamp and then redeploy where necessary some different strategies and capabilities to fight against this, because it's unfortunately a reality. Over the last year, we've continued to see a pretty significant uptick in those attacks. And when you think about AI, generative AI coming into this, we're starting to see more sophistication. We're starting to see more thoughtfulness, more planning, more sequencing of these attacks. And that, you know, requires us also to level up and figure out how do we leverage those same emerging technologies to protect and defend our interests and our data from these attacks.
And what does the answer become? Because if you ask that question, how can we level up to this? How can we face this? Fighting fire with regards to AI generated or just very sophisticated nation state actors or even the sophisticated script kiddies like Scattered Spider. I mean, young kids who are doing this. What do you see as the options? Again, as your middle point, you're not a hospital, but what are you doing to assist with the various care facilities then? Or what are your suggestions, if I may ask that question?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a great question. And I hopefully have a great answer. So here's what it comes down to. It comes down to understanding that threat actors are getting smarter, so we have to as well. So when we think about this, we have to think about it as a whole of nation issue. Yes, we are looking at it specifically from that healthcare sector, you know, one of 16 critical infrastructure sectors, but we have to start defending forward. And I thank General Paul Nakasone for this, is this idea of thinking about being proactive, not just reactive. You obviously have reactive capabilities, but we have to start, and we are doing this. This is exactly the answer to the question, right? Is understand that the tactics, techniques, and procedures of threat actors, we have to partner as industry, right? So we have to work with everybody within the sector, and we also have to include government in that, whether it's state or federal. So this idea of sharing intelligence in kind of this collective defense manner. So we share, you know, specifically at Premier, we share intelligence with the BCBSA, so the Blues. So 33, 34 different Blues plans across the country. We're sharing intelligence. We're working with law enforcement. We're working with the intelligence community. So as we see things and as we're defending things, as we, you know, identify those indicators of compromise, we're sharing those back out. And we're also receiving those to make sure that we're able to adjust our posture correctly so that we can defend. The other piece is around raising security awareness internally and also working with vendors and strategic partners that are aligned with this mindset. When you start doing that, you start to galvanize the effort. It starts to become a phalanx of capability and hardens the entire industry against and sector against these kind of attacks. So the ability for us to share at scale is truly what starts to make the difference, in my opinion.
So sharing at scale, and obviously there's a number of other organizations like CISA, for example, that are really interested in doing that as well. So we've got a shared knowledge base. Now, does that run up against any particular kinds of political or leadership challenges within hospitals, which again, essentially are for-profit centers? There's a cost issue with being proactive. There is a level of concern about being unnecessarily proactive. Do you see in general that most hospitals and other care centers are willing to undertake the expense to be proactive?
Well, I think they have to. I think as you're running a business, and Premier is a not-for-profit, so that is helpful. But within our organization, we've seen it as the highest priority, right, is to make sure that our members' data is protected and secure. That is a part of the value proposition when you're engaging with these members. These members have choice. And one of the things that they expect is for these organizations to protect their information. This is very sensitive information, protected health information, right? So I think there has to be a reframing and a real recalculus for those hospitals and other entities within healthcare to think about security in a different way and privacy in a different way. And what has forced this, it specifically, you know, if we look at ransomware, is this is locking up the operation, right? This is effectively stopping everything in its tracks. So the ability to ignore it is no longer an option. You have to deal with it. And you also have to be thinking about how are your customers, your members, your patients expecting you to react to this. So I think things have changed, right? This is no longer operating in the 70s. This is a real-time thing that is now in the boardrooms. Executive leadership is talking about it. Everybody has this on their radar. So it's a different business model now going forward.
And that's an excellent statement to say we're no longer operating in the 1970s. But at the same time, there's a lot of technical debt that any facilities in any industry are suffering from. The cost of patching legacy systems versus buying new ones and so forth. It's obviously an ongoing battle that can detract people from the focus of their work, whatever industry they happen to be in. So how can you influence healthcare centers to upgrading an infrastructure that continues to degrade just by age, leaving these open ports and points vulnerable? This is like talking about infection prevention for a human being. Do you take a role in advising in that area?
Oh, absolutely. A very active role. And you can tell by my personality that I've got lots to say. So one of the things that I think we've done and others, right, within the industry, this idea of tackling legacy systems is paramount. Because if you understand the way that a lot of these threat actors are leveraging those exposures within those legacy systems to be able to launch attacks, you have to address it. But it's important to explain why. It's also important to understand that it will take time. There are resources and choices that have to be made as you go and you upgrade and upskill not only your people, but your systems, you start to balance that out. But not doing anything and just kind of dragging these legacy and technical debt systems around is no longer an option. So you have to tackle it head on. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a bigger conversation, because you have to make sure that everybody understands why you're doing it. This is not an IT thing. The execution of those systems may be an IT thing, but it's a business problem, ultimately. You want to talk about choice and optionality when it comes to generative AI? Well, you're not going to be able to build those things at scale on those legacy systems. So you're limiting your optionality and your ability to differentiate in the space if you're not thinking about addressing those things. Oh, and by the way, yes, you also have to be thinking about your security posture, because those are the things that are considered porous and threat actors are looking and banking on that you haven't addressed, you haven't patched, that you still have these legacy things in your environment. So this idea of lifecycle management has become, Primera, it's become a habit. It's a sense of pride. We want to make sure that our systems are healthy. So we are proactively planning, prioritizing, and making sure that we're patching these systems. But I think it's a bigger business problem that has to be tackled. And there is some choice to be made and some investment to be put into it. But once you have that baked into your DNA, it's easier to maintain, right? It's easier to plan forward and think about, okay, this is going to be out of service. You know, this is at the end of its life cycle. What comes next? How are we thinking about that? What advantages do we get when we start to upgrade or change, you know, that system or that application? There's a lot of upsides, but you have to be intentional about doing it.
Do you think that third-party vendors hold an equal level of responsibility for this? Because they have sold some particular network or hardware stuff that has come to end of life, and they say, sorry, you know, you just got to buy the new version in order for it to continue to work. Is that just simply just the cost of doing business? Or do you think that they, the third-party vendors, who are often, by the way, the key unwitting culprit in so many of these attacks, do they get factored into this conversation as well as part of the regular conversation?
I think we've hit kind of a redefinition and a reframing by necessity, actually. So those relationships are no longer, you know, I keep referencing the 70s, but we don't have those relationships like we used to have. These things are so integrated and interconnected now that our relationships have to level up. And yes, everybody has a responsibility within an ecosystem. Because if you think about a business model, the ability to do things within your four walls no longer exists. There are things that you're going to need by necessity and by choice that you're going to offload to a vendor or a strategic partner to do. And with that comes a set of accountability and responsibilities that have to be maintained. So keeping that entire ecosystem healthy requires a active and sometimes contentious bidirectional dialogue. So yes, vendors absolutely have skin in the game and have some responsibility. And so do we as consumers. Or if you think about it this way, because of, you know, software as a service connectivity, there's also a bidirectional relationship and responsibility that we have to maintain from Primera's standpoint, because we're connected to them. So are we the weak link in the chain? So we also have to make sure that we're doing what's right, because we're also connected to them. So when you start to see this lattice work kind of grow and build, as long as everybody maintains and understands what their roles and responsibilities are and hold themselves accountable, you start to have a much healthier ecosystem to operate within and through, as opposed to, oh, not my problem, you take care of it. Well, guess what? I have choice. And I may choose not to work with you if that's the attitude that you're taking, because there's enough competitive landscape here that others will be able to step up and say, no, we will work with you. We will be proactive. We are accountable and responsible. And that's where the money goes.
Yeah, which is truly the as-a-service mentality, really, the agile approach to delivering what's necessary and upgrading as necessary as well. And I love your reference back to the 1970s, again, because first of all, it truly was the best decade. There's no question about that.
Well, that's
but secondly, again, when you choose to use terms like ecosystem, the symbiosis of people not just simply providing products in a supply chain as you would have seen in the 70s, but now a hugely interactive world that people are all responsible for being part of. So it's great to see that being brought front and center by you and by Primera like this. But it also leaves one other thing, which is the human beings. most of the time, humans end up getting blamed for cyber attacks because of something they have done, falling for a deepfake, social engineering, a phishing email, all these things that we're very familiar with as surface level attack vectors that take advantage of the one thing about humans that is our weak point, or one of many, that we will react without thinking. So how can you assist organizations in changing their mindset towards how to train people into proactive thinking, critical thinking, to be that last guardian against cyber threats by being allowed to take the time to think, especially in an emergency situation like healthcare, where every second counts? This seems like a huge paradox there. What would your advice be?
I have a few things on this one, and I think, and this is where I spend a lot of my time and a lot of my energy. Even in this age of AI, I would say that the human beings are even more important in the age of AI. What AI does and has given us is this ability and permission to look within, to really understand and to really value how human beings are a part of this solution. The idea that people are the problem because they made a mistake, we're human beings. So we always need to go back and really understand, you know, what's the definition of being human? We are not infallible. Things do happen. So when it comes to training, when it comes to awareness, specifically at Premier, we have a really robust security awareness program I'm super proud of. And we've taken a couple of different perspectives there. Steve, you and I were talking about, you know, kind of a humanistic approach to organization and really embracing the fact that we have people working for us, and that's a good thing. So what do we do? How do we start thinking about the messaging and the narratives around them? The biggest thing for us is to explain why. Why is this important? What is your role and responsibility in this? Why is security everyone's responsibility? Because when you start to take that time, you start to pause and you explain, you see literally the light bulbs going off like, oh, right, I understand. So if I do this, here's the cascading effect. If I click on this phishing email or if I enter my credentials and a threat actor gets it, they're able to do this, they're able to pivot, escalate privilege, take a foothold, exfil data. Sometimes organizations don't take the time to walk people through. They just want to like, oh, you need to do your mandatory training and that's it. But you have to take some time, right? There's a marketing and a salesperson effort behind this as well, right? You have to think about, well, what's the message? What's the narrative that we really want to land here? And what that requires is truly, you know, understanding, you know, human psychology and some empathy and compassion with how you deliver that message. So programs that really resonate with people, you start to see people empowered and understand what their role is. And I think that makes all the difference. So the human firewall is a powerful control. Not that other controls don't matter, because they do, but human beings are absolutely the tip of the spear. You get that right and everything else will start to fall into place. People, process, technology. Start with people, the rest will align to that.
In terms of, let's say, operational resilience and incident response, how does Primera ensure operational resilience? And what perhaps have you learned from past incidents about effective recovery? What can you tell us as a story about how you have helped in a really critical situation?
I think there's a couple of ways to think about this. And from a story standpoint, we can talk about Change Healthcare and what happened there. There was a lot of empathy and a lot of compassion when Change Healthcare was hit by ransomware and the ripple effect. Not only did it highlight the fact that there were nodes and nexus points within our ecosystem that when they went down, everything started to stop like, oh, wow, wait a sec. Change is down. So we can't do all of these things. So I think as a community, first of all, yes, we wanted to understand, well, what happened? But there was an interesting thing that also happened where people were leaning in. Well, how can we help? What are the alternatives? Not only how can we help Change, but also how can we start to bring back our infrastructure so that, you know, doctors can get paid, patients can be seen, people can get their drugs, pharmacies can continue to do what they need to do. All of a sudden, you started to see people thinking about alternatives. And this is what I say about, you know, human beings, right? It's just amazing the resilience and the adaptability that we have when there's a crisis. People start leaning in and they start thinking about things way outside the box to be able to solve a problem. So that's what we saw. Now, you know, the dust starts to settle. A lot of conversations about, you know, after the fact, how did they get a foothold? How do we validate? Who were your forensic investigators? All of these things. But after those conversations, we start to think about, okay, we need, and we've been doing this for a few years now, is this resilience mindset. Sometimes it feels like it's an overused word, resiliency. The thing here is you have to expect, assume that not only threat actors, but other things are going to happen to take down your service in some way, shape, or form. Remember what your promise is to your members, and for us, it's to our members and our customers, that we are expected to be online available so that they can get access to the healthcare that they need. So with that in mind, you start thinking about, how do you build resilient systems? How do you have redundancies in place? This goes beyond just normal disaster recovery or business continuity, which are truly the foundations of this concept. But when you start thinking about resilience at scale, everybody, you know, is brought into that conversation. So you create net new playbooks around, you know, different scenarios, ransomware being one of the key ones these days, but you start doing some more tabletop exercises. Maybe you bring in some different functions that you haven't brought in before to have a conversation. I always say, train the way you fight the way you train. You create specialty teams like crisis management teams, incident response teams, comms teams that are specifically trained for when something goes bump in the night. So all of a sudden now you have all of these elements and attributes working in concert to make sure that you have this elasticity built into your business model, because you're assuming that something bad will happen. If you live in Florida, hurricanes happen there. So what do? Yes, you have things that you put on your windows and doors because that is the environment that you're living in. So this is no different, right? We have to take on this resilience mindset because this is the environment. This is the situation that we are living in today. So you have to learn from those situations. You have to be empathetic and compassionate. Think about what it's like to be, you know, that CISO or that management team while you're going through this, and what would it be like if it was us? How would we do things differently? What can we learn from that? So having that resilience mindset, I think, makes all the difference in the world. And that's what we did. So as Blues, we came together. We were working with change. We were getting information. We were trying to figure out different ways to stand up different capabilities across our U.S. healthcare system. We came together as a system and we were sharing information at scale. So these are real world things. This is no longer theoretical. This is what's really happening in real time.
Like SolarWinds, for most people, do you have a particular most memorable healthcare cybersecurity events that has happened that you always think about when you frame your mindset?
It's a great question, Steve. And one of the ones that I think about, there were actually a couple of hospitals last year, and in particular, and I'm struggling to remember the name of the hospital, but it was a children's hospital that did get hit by ransomware.
Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Yes, absolutely.
That's the one. And that was literally like crossing the Rubicon for me, right? That was the red line. I felt that, not that there was a need for me to be motivated, but that was an amplifier for me. When I saw a threat actor throw ransomware and lock up that hospital system for children, I was motivated. When I'm kind of, you know, kind of down in the mouth, right? And I'm like, you know, this is really hard. That's what I think about. I think about those kids needing access to their healthcare and they can't. So I'm going to be a defender. I'm going to be proactive. I got to fight for them because they can't fight for themselves. So that's what I think about.
So just as a closer, what would you like people to leave knowing more about Primera? What do they need to know about you, yourself as a speaker and an expert, but also, of course, as Primera?
I think there's a couple of things. There's a reason why I work at Primera Blue Cross. Primera has, for years now, taken on a big challenge of making healthcare work better. And it means it. There's substance there. It's not just a bumper sticker or a t-shirt. All of our efforts are predicated and focused on our customers and our members. We care, and I see it. I see it every day, the people that I talk to, with the interactions that I have, and that means something to me. I could be doing other things other places, but I choose to be here because we're making a difference. It's real, and I think that's important. when you start to see the complexities and the struggles and now the targeting of healthcare, it's too much. So being at Primera has been great. The ideas that we have that we're bringing to market move the needle. One of the other differentiators from my perspective is the fact that we listen. We actually listen to our members and our customers. If there's something that we need to do differently, there's kind of a co-creation that's happening. Even as we think about generative AI products and services that we're going to be bringing to market, it's all based on feedback as well as our own insights from data, but from interactions. Again, this isn't about technology. It's about human beings. If you remember that at the core, then you will always find yourself, you know, kind of course correcting correctly. That is the true north. This is about our patients and members, period, full stop.
This has been an absolute delight. Every word you have shared with us has value. So thank you very much for being here on the Talos Security Sessions podcast.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for inviting me. I had a great time and great questions and a really thoughtful and rich discussion. It means a lot. So thank you.
Remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and tell a friend or a colleague or all of them about the Talos Security Sessions podcasts. Not just for the next episode, but for our valuable and thorough collection of past ones. All of them on the topics that you need to know about to successfully carry on in the business of information security. We will be back again soon with another timely discussion. And until then, I'm Steve Prentice. Thanks for listening.